Next on The Old Mole, Luisa Martinez interviews Peter Cole on the second edition of his book titled Ben Fletcher, Life and Times of a Black Wobbly. Peter Cole is a professor of history at Western Illinois University in Macomb and a research associate in the Society Work and Development Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Cole is the author of the award-winning Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area, and Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. And he is the founder and co-director of the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. Luisa?
Peter, thanks so much for joining us. The IWW was founded as an anti-racist organization because they understood racial divisions as a tool for the bosses to maintain control over workers. Could you explain why the IWW organizer Ben Fletcher was considered so dangerous to both the capitalist class and then later on the FBI?
Yeah, of course. Fletcher was so dangerous because he was a revolutionary young black worker who has taken the leadership role in what could be the most large, militant, multiracial, multiethnic union in the country in that era, the 19-teens, the World War I era. Of course, the IWW was also hated by, as you say, both capitalists and the government, and that didn't mean just Fletcher, but really to be a Wobbly was to have a target on your back, especially once World War I began, because it was the largest, most influential union in the United States and the world, really, before World War I, that was committed very overtly to getting rid of capitalism and instituting a socialist world economy. And so Fletcher was a part of this revolutionary milieu, but the fact that he was himself an African-American who led an incredibly diverse union that controlled one of the largest waterfronts in the country, that also was why Fletcher in particular was arrested and then tried and later imprisoned, along with a bunch of other Wobblies in 1918.
In your intro, you state that you don't attempt to kind of extradite Ben Fletcher's life from the life and history of his union, of Local 8. I'm curious, why did you choose that route as opposed to, you know, a more straightforward biography about an unusually talented organizer in the face of multiple types of oppression?
Yeah, there is a lot of ways one, I suppose, could approach it. As a historian, I have always sort of been interested in unions and social movements more broadly, essentially how people collectively have more power than they have individually, and how most of the great changes in the country and world that have occurred have happened in that way, right? Organized collective action, and that workers in particular have more power than other groups of people, arguably than at the ballot box. So for me, I guess I saw the union as really the key story in and of himself. Fletcher is not important. It's because of what he was able to do and considering who he was. I mean, but he was one person. One person doesn't change the world. But when one person, as a part of a group of 5,000 workers, are able to sort of really radically improve their own lives, change their conditions, and then also sort of be a part of a much larger organization, to me, that's actually the story. But there's also the reality that the ordinary people of the past have very little written about them. They themselves didn't keep such good records. They didn't keep journals, write diaries. The correspondence that they might have had or did have is often lost. And so it's very hard, actually, to tell a book-length story about an individual who isn't an elite person. And since Ben Fletcher was both a working-class man, but also an African-American in the early 20th century, the truth is that there's a lot we don't know about him. And so what we do know about him is, in particular, his role, his sort of central role in sort of organizing Philadelphia dock workers, and then being sort of an important player in the industrial works of the world nationwide, that we know. What he liked for breakfast, his personal relationships, but sadly, we know very, very little about those parts of his life. And so to me, it's really sort of in a way a sort of the public life of Ben Fletcher. I'd love to and would be deeply interested in knowing much more about Ben Fletcher's personal life. But sadly, we don't have that information anymore. And he had no children and no sort of collection of papers. And so the approach that I took for writing his biography, I think, was logical and for multiple ways, but it's really because of what he did as a part of this organization, right? I mean, leaders matter, but leaders only matter if they have a lot of followers. And so Fletcher was so interesting because he led this incredibly powerful, militant, multiracial union in a time when racism and xenophobia and anti-unionism was the norm.
IW's insistence, it wasn't just acceptance of racial and gender unity, it was insistence around it, are supported certainly by the historical texts you cite, but it's also evident that representation was important as well. And so how did either Local 8 or Fletcher himself understand these concepts, and how did it inform wobbly organizing at that time?
Yeah, you can't imagine Ben Fletcher being a part of any organization other than the IWW in the 19-teens, because when the IWW was founded in 1905, it was very intentionally founded by revolutionaries and radicals, men and women, who were not only anti-capitalists, but also were understood deeply that racism and sexism sort of were part of the equation of how essentially the ruling class divides and conquers the working class. And simultaneously, Fletcher believes that, as far as we know. He was a great organizer and supposedly a brilliant speaker and very funny man, but his paper trail is limited, right? And so what we know about Fletcher's sort of thoughts on these matters is that at some level, Fletcher believed that Black workers were no different than other sorts of workers, that capitalism was the primary source of oppression, and that working class people needed to organize across all divisions within them in order to sort of overcome capitalism. At the same time, as a Black man whose parents very possibly were born enslaved, even though we don't know for sure, but we know that his parents were born in Virginia in the 1850s, you wouldn't have to tell Ben Fletcher that Black people got a particularly raw deal in the United States. And so I don't want to understate the realities of racism, and that as a Black man, he wasn't anti-racist. But as a socialist, he actually believed that the only and best path forward is through sort of multiracial unionism in particular. I would also point out, for people who may not be thinking about it, is that in the 1920s, the teens and 20s, there was a very large Black organization in the U.S. and the world called the Universal Negro Improvement Association, led by Marcus Garvey. And Garvey was this brilliant Jamaican political revolutionary who lived in Harlem and had over a million people belong to his organization in multiple countries. But Garveyism was a separatist. And so for someone like Fletcher, if he's thinking about, you know, okay, we need to form Black worker unions, that would make sense given discrimination against Black people. But simultaneously, you have this separatist organization that really is putting race first in a way that Fletcher and other socialists rejected, and that Garvey really wasn't thinking at all about capitalism. He actually just wanted to be a part of capitalism. He just wanted a fair shake for Black people, but didn't trust white people to make it happen. So we can understand Fletcher in the context of his time as being much more interested in interracial unionism as opposed to sort of Black organizations. And that made him similar to people like A. Philip Randolph, probably the best known labor and socialist African-American who comes out of that same era. Although Fletcher dies much earlier than Randolph, so Randolph is also much better known.
So let me ask, what do you think, considering there's so limited information in terms of his early life, even his personal life, do you have a particular theory for why he went that route?
So that's a great question. It's an important question. And my answer is sort of weak. I have opinions. I guess I would call them educated opinions, but I don't know. We don't even know precisely when he joined the IWW. It was probably around 1910. He was born in 1890, so he was about 20 years old. Might have been 1911. But so we know about when he joined. He also pretty certainly, but not definitively, joined the Socialist Party of America at that time, or around that time. And that would have been common. There was a lot of Wobblies who were socialists and vice versa. Big Bill Haywood was a famous Wobbly leader who also in that same moment was also a member of the Socialist Party. But so we can guess, here's this poor Black guy. He suffers like most sort of working class kids would have in Philadelphia in the first decade of the 20th century. He didn't finish high school, although he's clearly very smart and well-read based on the correspondence that we can read and that are included in the book. But it's not because of a formal education. He probably finished school by the age of 15 or 16 at best. And so I surmised that Fletcher was walking down the streets of his neighborhood in Philadelphia, which was a working class area, industrial areas, lots of people, not just Black people. It wasn't really segregated the way it later became, right? And that he probably started to meet and hear wobbly speakers on the streets. He later, shortly thereafter, I should say, became a very well-known soapbox speaker in Philadelphia and neighboring towns. And so it's reasonable to conclude that he basically was sort of organized by some wobblies who, you know, chatted him up, maybe gave him a newspaper like Solidarity or Industrial Worker, maybe sort of set him aside. He probably watched more than once before he decided to sort of maybe take a pamphlet or come back. But that he was convinced because of his life experience, but also probably because, well, the wobblies were already organizing in his neighborhood in the city of Philadelphia. And that he also joined the Socialist Party is pretty clear that he has already at a young age, right, rejected capitalism as the preferred economic system that humans should live under. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how the government investigated Fletcher that, you know, ultimately led to this trial, particularly, and I'm reading from your book here, for Chapter 17, this is a report made by Agent Henry Bowen to what we now understand to be the FBI. It was then the U.S. Department of Justice Bureau of Investigation. But he's writing this report about Fletcher, and he says, this is, you know, before they had entered his house, another agent entered his house pretending to be a health inspector. This was kind of a follow-up visit. And he writes, Fletcher is a real type of Southern N-word agitator, obviously self-censoring here. With no education, poor grammar, he is about 5'9 in height, weighs 185 pounds, and is reputed by the police as a bad man or gunfighter. He did not display any of that to agent. In reference to other matters about articles purported to be written by a, quote, colored citizen, in which the draft act is criticized, does not think Fletcher capable of expressing himself in the same manner as these matters have been expressed. Agent feels that Fletcher is not very harmful to the U.S. government. Later on, of course, he was indicted and he showed up a couple hours late to his to the trial, and even then had to demonstrate ID that he actually he needed to be inside the courtroom because the bailiff wouldn't let him in. So my question is, how did the constant undermining of Fletcher's intelligence work in favor of his organizing, if only for, you know, limited time?
Well, like there's a bunch of good questions sort of embedded in there. But it's interesting, actually, because this Agent Bowen, right, who's this sort of federal agent who's spying on Fletcher, surveying him in Boston, where he's living in the summer of 1917. It's not clear, actually, that he knows Fletcher. It's so interesting because he says he's 5'9 and weighs 185. Well, actually, no, he was 5'4, right? And
yeah.
Although he was stocky, I doubt actually he weighed 185, and he totally sort of is duped by Fletcher, you know, that Fletcher basically is playing a role for Bowen if he's this real Southern agitator, because of course he's not even Southern, he's from Philadelphia. Okay. So there's so many things we might think about, but, you know, the bigger issues are, first and foremost, like you said, he's being spied on. America declares war in April 1917. Really, less than 2 months later, the U.S. Congress creates the Espionage Act. Later, the following year, the Sedition Act added. But the Espionage Act that basically criminalizes dissent. And then 2 months into the war, U.S. part of the war, they're already basically have Fletcher and many other wobblies in the sort of May-June of 1917 under surveillance. There wasn't even time for the IWW to organize resistance to the war if they had chosen to. And they've already been targeted, right? And so let us keep it without any evidence that Fletcher has in fact done anything wrong. He's already been spied on. It's interesting that they find him in Boston. He had been in Norfolk earlier in 1917, where he was organizing, and was threatened with lynching, according to his local friends. And so he was smuggled onto a ship and went up to Boston. And then he just lived in Boston for a few months. And he actually ended up marrying a woman in Boston that same time. And then is sort of, as he's being surveyed, and then when he's indicted, as were 150 other wobblies, rather than turn himself in, he was not obligated to do so, although some did, he just sort of hung out. And then he and his new wife and his stepchild basically lived sort of in Philadelphia, his home city, until the police got around to finding him 5 months later, practically. And so the stories are sort of fascinating if we're thinking about Fletcher's life experience in this moment. He'll then sort of, as you said, get on a train and go to Chicago, because the federal trials against the entire IWW leadership in Chicago, which was the headquarters of the IWW. And, you know, then he has to sort of almost convince the prison guards to let him into the courtroom, because they don't even know really who the hell this guy is. But Fletcher apparently is honest enough to travel across country and turn himself into court, where even though he knew that fair trial was unlikely given the sort of the hostility that the IWW already experienced from the U.S. federal government.
In past interviews, you said you're a historian who believes we study the past, understand the present, and change the future. Thank you so much, Peter, for spending time and talking about your book.